Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I don't know.
So why don't you just say, like at the beginning of Frankenstein, just a friendly word of warning.
Just a friendly word of warning. The episode you're about to hear contains the usual jovial badinage that you're used to. But in the conversation with Allison Anders, we discuss at great length Hollywood's history of dealing on screen with sexual assault. If that's a topic that you find upsetting, we suggest you give this one a pass and come back next week. One heads up, I check here from now on out. I'm not being rude. Well, I am being rude, but it's not checking text. I'm usually looking things up so I don't sound like
an idiot. No problem. Because I had to look him up. I didn't realize he was German, too.
Who?
Anthony Mann? Anthony Mann, yeah.
Thomas Mann, his brother.
No.
Oh, come on. I would believe it.
I will, especially for me. By the way, the and I'm going to, when I go back and record the little preludes to the episodes, we have to, Adolf Caesar was not the guy who did Jaws or those other films.
He didn't do Jaws?
No.
Well, so who was he?
He did other stuff.
Oh, I thought for sure that was his voice.
No, somebody else with a great name. I don't know. Rifkin,
another black
guy,
though.
Yeah. Rifkin had lunch with Landis, and they discussed it, and they called you out.
I mean,
the great thing, Joe shows up for these sometimes. It's always a thrill to have him, and it's like having a human encyclopedia here. So when you and I are unaware of the fact that people were...
That's it.
He just tries to show me up.
I have nothing. But shall we want to...
Let's just go.
Yeah, we'll just go.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Josh Olson, and you're listening to The Movies That Made Me, the official podcast of Trailers from Hell. I can't even look at it while I'm saying this because but I'm so excited. I mean, I'm always happy to have anyone who will come in and talk to us. But today we have the unbelievably great writer-director Allison Anders with us. I first became, like a lot of people, I wasn't hip enough to know about Border Radio, but I came to her in the early 90s, mm-hmm. with at the peak of that. Of course, it was 1992, the greatest year for movies in my life, through an amazing film in the midst of that kind of great indie explosion that was happening. She wrote and directed a wonderful movie called Gas Food Lodging, which just killed me in theaters, and I've seen it a dozen times since then. And it seemed like in the midst of this whole thing where everyone was being kind of arch and ironic and meta and everything, here was this human voice telling really human stories with obviously an understanding of women, but and maybe we can get into a little of this, I assume, because you co-wrote these with a man as well. I like to think that he probably brought a little bit of insight into our gender.
Oh, yeah.
But Gas Food Lodging just killed me, and she has gone on to do many other wonderful films, Mi Vida Loca came after that. Four Rooms, of course. Grace of My Heart, which, aside from being just an absolutely beautiful film and a wonderful performance from Emiliana Douglas, somehow you brought Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach together, and that ended up being, aside from the film, one of my favorite albums of all time and one of the most surreal concert-going experiences I ever had, because going to see Elvis Costello and having Burt Bacharach come out and we're all singing Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head was just bizarre.
So
but Allison has done a lot. She also did Things Behind the Sun, which we'll be talking about a bit today as well. And she's doing a lot, like a lot of great directors these days, doing a lot of good work in TV. Keep seeing your name pop up on Orange is the New Black, which always makes me happy. But we are here today because we don't like to interview people about their work because they've done that interview. Allison wanted to talk about two of her favorite directors who influenced her work, over the years and kind of do an interesting, it's an interesting compare and contrast, I think, too. Anthony Mann and Ida Lupino, who both had sort of interestingly similar interests and styles and yet were very different in at least one significant way. Totally. But I don't know, should we just sort of jump in? I mean, you told me when we were talking the other day that Man from Miami had a big influence on you while you were writing Gas Food Lodging. Mm-hmm. And you also said that Outrage, the Ida Lupino film, had influenced your work on Things Behind the Sun.
Yes.
And I use that as an excuse to kind of jump back and rewatch three of those movies. I'd never seen Outrage. I had to go to the ends of the earth to find a copy of it.
Oh, my God, right?
Yeah. Do you want to start there? Should we?
Yes.
Talk about a movie that's almost impossible to find. And
yes. And now you can see it turn up now and then on TCM.
Yes.
You know, and the way that I found it was through none other than Martin Scorsese, who I was working with on Grace of My Heart. And he was my exec producer. And then I was cutting with Thelma. I mean, how lucky am I? Whenever I don't have a crappy day and I'm not very grateful, I'm like, well, I sat in the room with Thelma, you know. So she was cutting Grace of My Heart, and I realized I needed to make Things Behind the Sun. So I hadn't written the script yet. I was about to write it. I needed to work through that piece of my own experience with sexual assault. And I co-wrote it with Kurt Voss, but we hadn't begun to write it yet. And so I told, you know, Marty has that fabulous library, of course, and at the time it was right there in, I don't know where it is now, but it was right there in the office where we were editing. So, you know, so I said, I want to see every movie made about rape. And he was so, of course, so great. He says, okay, well, you know, there aren't that many about rape. There are lots of rapes in movies. I think at the time it was something like 1 in 4 movies had rapes in them somewhere. But to actually be about the subject, it's true, there were so few. Yeah. It was kind of amazing. Now, he was also working on that A Journey Through Movies documentary.
Yes.
At the time.
Great documentary.
And Thelma was cutting that. And he had a clip of Outrage in there. Because he had, you know, a little chunk on Ida Lupino as a director. So he had that film. So I was able to see it, and I was completely blown away. I mean, I'm blown away by it to this very day, because the amazing thing for me is how the movie is only about that. It is completely about nothing else. It's about this girl who's, she's a young woman. She works at a coffee shop, and she's engaged to be married. She has a great family. She has a great life, simple life, and she's raped. And she's raped by a guy that all she can remember is a scar on his neck that she sees when the assault is happening. Now, the amazing thing about that for me is that, and this went into making Things Behind the Sun, is that, and through all my research later on rape, is that, you know, the reason that it's very hard for women to identify an assailant is that your adrenaline takes over, and you'll have this heightened sense of reality. You know, you'll have this heightened sense of awareness, so that you'll remember like a scar, but maybe you don't remember the face. You know, so it's all this stuff that goes into protecting you in trauma. It's how it works. It's like trauma memory. So that was before anybody even knew this stuff. So that Ida made that choice as a director to to shoot it that way so that we're in her point of view and we're seeing the one thing that she remembers about this guy. Now, we, as an audience, have seen the guy's face, but she hasn't. She's seen it, but she doesn't clock that that's the guy.
Yeah, because he works at the coffee truck outside
her
office.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and so she hasn't clocked that that's the guy because all she can remember is this heightened moment. And that's what really saves your life. And trauma is that moment saves your life. And so she, so the rest of the movie is her not being able to, it's her experience immediately after the assault and where she's showering, scrubbing herself clean kind of thing. She can't get clean. It's one of these things that so many rape survivors talk about. And then she just goes away. She just goes on this journey. She can't live her life anymore. She feels like she can't live her life anymore.
Well, the people around her are very... It's a different time, I guess.
Yes, so, yeah. And they're very sympathetic, but they don't know what to do for her.
Right.
And nobody's judging her. I mean, it's the best of circumstances, seemingly, but nobody knows how to help her.
Well, they all treat her like she's terribly broken.
Yes, they treat her like she's broken. And in a weird way, she kind of is. But brilliantly, in the end, I don't think she's broken anymore. I think she got all her pieces back. And she's whole again. She's gone through this journey that she knew she needed to do, and she does it. So... that one movie, I think, is beyond. I mean, it almost makes me cry now talking about it because it's so powerful. And it was just, you know, I don't know. I asked my mom, did you ever see this movie? No, I never heard it. You know, my mom went to the movies constantly and wrote in her diary and everything. But she had missed it at the time. And so... That was one of my essentials for a sort of cornerstone for making things Behind the Sun. And I really worked on trying to get that sort of heightened, that sense of heightened trauma memory and heightened reality from the perspective of the victim. And... you know, just really tried to work on all of the things that she had put out there.
Well, it's an interesting double feature for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
My wife Nancy thanks you for that evening we had. First of all, it's interesting note in Outrage, you never actually see the rape, and that word rape is never used,
right?
Of course. One of the things I thought was interesting was that, and I'm still trying to figure out, and I'd love to know what you think. Obviously, Ida Lupino worked on the script as well, mm-hmm. and as a woman at that time would be far more, I think, sort of sensitive to, obviously, what women endure just in general. But there are scenes, especially there's a scene with her fiancé when she's thinking her life is over and they certainly can't get married anymore because she's broken. And she gets out of the car crying and he chases after her and he grabs her and he spins her around and he's holding her tight. And he's like, you listen to me. It's like our life may never be the same and you may be broken, but we are getting married because I love. And it's this, by kind of the standards of a 1950s film, he's being sort of the noble hero and look at him the way, because that's what you do is you manhandle women until they come around to you.
Oh, yeah.
Because he knows best.
Exactly.
But it's just kind of horrifying the way he's treating her.
I can't.
Come here.
Let me go.
Don't talk like that. We're going to be married right away. I want you. I want to live with you. I want to have kids with you. We can be happy like other people.
We're not like other people. I don't want to get married ever. I don't want you to touch me.
I kept thinking, you know, if a man had written and directed this film, that scene would feel a little bit different. And I'm wondering if, you know, Ida was playing with a little bit of irony there, a little bit of understanding that this guy is kind of an asshole. Or,
well, it's funny because that you say this, because on Gas Food Lodging, I had each of the male actors had come to me at some point separately. They hadn't talked amongst themselves that I know of, but they had all come to me separately and said, you know, I think there's a scene missing. And the scene missing was that scene, was the scene where he tells the woman, hey, I love you, and this is how it's going to be, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, each one was that kind of a thing. And then finally I was, I didn't come with any kind of agenda to making movies, or, you know, but I was like, oh, I see. I get what you're saying. No, no, you don't. We don't do that in this movie. We don't have to do that in this movie. It's okay. You can just relax. You can just, you know. So I think that there is something. Yeah, that's that. It's and that he, kind of moment.
And for, even the minister at the end, who's kind of more of a good guy, although he's a little creepy.
Yes. Yeah, sort I of, know.
She wants to. He tells her what she needs to do at the end.
Yes,
you need to go back
true.
To your life, and she goes, "Gosh, you're right." And which is it? Because there's a lot of kind of similarity in terms of the way the men treat Kim Dickens in Things Beyond the Sun.
Right.
But there's the awareness that they're wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
It's and they're called out for that in your film, which is.
Yeah. And they're all kind of, I mean, I used this, this book actually on Things Behind the Sun. I used a book by, a therapist, who kind of created the sex addiction clinic at the Meadows in the news recently. But he, Patrick Carnes, and he, one of the, he wrote an amazing book called The Betrayal Bond, and it's about trauma and how when there's a trauma, especially an assault, or, you know, you go into this trauma mode and it's saving your life, and you also bond with the perpetrator, you know, so you bond with the perpetrator to kind of like Stockholm syndrome that we all know about. So you bond with the perpetrator so that you lessen your risk of being killed. And but the problem is that after the trauma's over, your brain is still thinking that you're still in trauma mode. And that you're still bonding with perpetrators and bonding with people you shouldn't be bonding with to save your life. So he had this triangle, and the triangle was like, there's the victim, the perpetrator, and the caregiver. So that was kind of brilliant for me to work with in terms of Kim Dickens being the victim, Gabriel Mann portraying the perpetrator to a certain extent, and Don Cheadle portraying the caregiver. But one thing that Karn says is they will all shift positions within that triangle. Hmm. And they'll play out different roles. So none of it's healthy, not even the caregiver. You know, the caregiver seems like, oh, well, she has a caregiver, but that's not good either. And so that
and
was
there seems to be a little awareness of that in Outrage even, which is interesting because
yes.
we didn't have any of that.
Exactly,
thinking.
Without any of that psychology. That's what's yeah. incredible to me is that. And she, it wasn't that she just, you know, she knew this. She had this knowledge. And we know that because of how she shot it.
Yeah.
You know, how she filmed it shows that she knew what this experience was all about.
Yeah.
You know, whether she knew it personally or not, she knew it. She knew what she was trying to say.
And we have, my God, we have, of course, the great Joe Dante here with us, who knows everything and anything there is to know on the subject.
Just listening.
Please.
So, Allison, did Ida Lupino just kind of, I mean, obviously she was a big movie star and these opportunities come up. Did she just kind of fall into directing, or do you know if it was more of a plan on her part, something that was always the idea?
Well, it's an interesting thing because, of course, people think that if they're on the set observing for years, that they know how to do, you know, a lot of jobs, especially directing. But you know, I mean, as a director, I wouldn't presume that I know how to act just because I work with actors, or that I could, you know, be the DP or even the editor. So I think that for a long time, because she was the only one in the 50s, the only woman directing movies for studios, and these were the smaller studios at that, that she just sort of fell into it. But in fact, or that the director was axed and then she just kind of went, oh, hey, I'll do it.
Well, yeah, they do that lottery when the director's fired. Just right. Who just wants like, to?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Okay, so I'll step up and call action.
That's actually how I got to direct my one film.
There we go.
I was a PA.
So, but in fact, what's the really great story here is that, in fact, directing was always the plan for Ida Lupino. Her parents were actors. She wanted to be a filmmaker.
Were they as in a child. Movies?
They were in movies, yeah. They were actors in the theater, and they were actors in movies. And they were English. She's English, you know. And so when she decided to become an actress as a teenager, her father made a deal with her. And he was like, well, we will let you become an actress and pursue that if you don't lose sight of the fact that you want to direct movies. And so that was her pact with her father, was that eventually, and every now and then he would nudge her as she was becoming a very big star, you know, but remember, you've got your movie to make. And so eventually, at the point that it's true, you know, that at the point that maybe there weren't as many roles for her, the time had come. But it really was part of the plan all along. So that's kind of, that is the really remarkable story about Ida Lupino. It's enough that she was already a director in the 50s as a woman, but that she had this plan. She also just really knew how to navigate that in a way that I think a lot of women later needed to find out on their own as well, which was, how do you take control of your crew as a director, as a woman? And so she made that movie star pass work for her, where she'd come to set dressed like a movie star, and she'd sit in her chair like an actress and with her jewelry, and she'd go, darling, could you move that light over here for me? So, you know, so that she was never intimidating her male crew, because it was almost all male crew that were used to working with male directors. So she didn't try to compete with the male directors. She just used her movie star status.
And they knew how to, that's brilliant, because those same crew would know how to work with a woman who was a movie star. And
absolutely.
How to adapt to her.
Absolutely.
That's incredible.
She just really worked that. And then at the end, they kind of, you know, I'll never forget seeing the chair that they made for her. They made the director's chair that said, Mother to Us All.
Ugh.
And so later, some crew members heard me saying that on the set of Things Behind the Sun. And at the end of the, at the wrap of my film, they presented me with a chair that said Mother to Us All. So, you know, I just think that that was, and that was my approach also, was when I started, was to disarm by using a sort of Earth Mother approach. I knew that I had this thing going for me, so I just thought, okay, I'll wear flowers in my hair and long flowery dresses, and then I can get what I need on set. So, you know, we don't have to play those tricks so much anymore, but hey, whatever you get doesn't hurt, you know?
Oh, that's wonderful.
So she and her then husband, Collier Young, formed a company called The Filmmakers, and they made independent, true independent movies, which I don't think even had necessarily distribution set up. And they did a whole series of very odd, offbeat, and interesting movies about people. Mm-hmm. You know, there. I mean, every so often there was a genre movie thrown in there, like The Hitchhiker,
mm-hmm.
which is a great movie, but it's also got characters in it.
I mean, yeah,
it's, yeah.
It's, and you know, she said that she it was considered the poor man's Don Siegel. She had gone from being the poor man's Betty Davis to the Don Siegel. The movies were one of the reasons you don't see Outrage is because it was very spottily distributed because of the subject matter.
Right.
And you know, her previous movie that she had gotten a chance to direct was Not Wanted, which was an adoption
mm-hmm.
movie
mm-hmm.
where the, mm-hmm. the she wrote it and she produced it, but the director, whose name was Elmer Clifton, who is an odd choice for this movie because his main he went back to silent movies, but he had mainly been working in very low budget westerns, and I don't know if they were friends or how he got that job, but he had a heart attack, and she had to direct the picture, and that was her baptism of fire because it was like, well, now that I've really got to deliver here, and that picture turned out very well, and then Hard, Fast, and Beautiful was the tennis movie.
Right.
And they all have, some of them have recurring cast members, but her sister shows up, no stars. They're all character actors.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a pretty unique, I mean, except for Dorothy Arzner, I can't think of another woman director who directed that many movies, except maybe Lois Weber or somebody in the 20s.
And then also to have moved into TV like she did so early on, like as a woman.
Well, my generation knew her from a show called Mr. Adams and Eve, which she did with her husband, her then husband, Howard Duff, and they played married movie stars, and it was a syndicated sitcom.
It was
funny, but I mean, for an 11-year-old to think this is funny, it must have been fairly funny. Otherwise, it was hard to relate to. But she, you know, and you know, she was always really gorgeous and always mm-hmm. a good actress.
Great actress,
and had a real style to her, and she could be very brittle. I mean, she's versatile. She's very.
And the women in the movies where she had, she did films with women characters, young women characters at the forefront too. In addition doing the movies with the guys.
But I think what's really interesting, you look at The Hitchhiker, and I don't know, this is just a crazy theory, but I feel like if a man had written and directed that film, The Hitchhiker would have picked up a couple. Because there's just that sense that it's always more frightening if there's a woman being menaced. And the fact that it's these two, I mean, they're just like two war buddies.
Yeah,
I think they are war buddies, aren't they?
Right.
Who are picked up. And it's still incredibly tense because she's not having that. She's not going, it's more frightening if a woman's
being menaced. And also, another movie that she did that was very controversial at the time was The Bigamist.
Oh, yes.
Which also stars Edmund O'Brien. I guess they were friends.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a different family in different places. And in the two women represent the two views of women that were popular in the 50s. And you know, he gets the Madonna and the whore. And how he manages to keep this thing going is it's a little melodramatic, but it's a really fascinating subject, because when you think about it, I mean, what other mainstream movie would be about that subject?
Right? Yeah.
I mean, there wouldn't
so
be. No, because the studio wouldn't make a picture like
that. It's so true. Yeah, and it really makes sense that Outrage would not have done, that some people would have just not picked that up at all.
The prevailing thought was movies are entertainment.
Yes, exactly.
And depending on the subject matter, you know, a movie can be moving and great and change your life, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be entertaining.
Exactly.
In the normal
sense. Well, also, and there are some issues that we just stay away from in 1950.
Yeah.
I felt that way even with Things Behind the Sun, because I had two offers when we took the film to Sundance. We had two offers. And the first one was, through a company that I knew they loved the movie, and it was for theatrical release. The second one was for Showtime, and that was a larger amount of money that, you know, where my investors would get all their money back from that deal. But it meant that it would be on TV, which was really very risky move back then. Like, that wasn't... This wasn't times the golden...
Yeah. This is only, what, 10 years
not
ago?
This was not the golden age of TV yet.
Now you
so
jump
it was
that.
Like,
yeah.
But it was funny because I thought, you know, that theatrical company, I know that they really love the movie. They're not going to love it after the second weekend. I knew that because I thought, I know that this subject matter is going to be really tough. And a girlfriend of mine, she worked at Fine Line at the time, and she said, listen, Allison, if you can get past the vanity of the theatrical screening, I guarantee you, you will have more people see this movie, and there will be people who need to see it will be able to see it. And I tell you, I was watching Giant on TV at the time, and I was like going, I love this movie so much. This is like one of my favorite movies. And I was like, and you've never once seen it on the screen, have you, right. Alice? And I was like, okay, I believe it. I'm a believer. So it's like, all right, well, I'll do it. And I never looked back. But it was, you know, even at that time, in 2000, you know, it was too risky to put it in the theaters. Yeah. You know, it wouldn't have done well. And then Monsters Ball came out and would have taken every single bit of, you know, that was kind of enough for that year,
right.
You know.
But it's interesting too that subject, you know, what you said earlier about how frequently it showed up in films and how rarely it was the subject.
Oh yeah.
Well, movies. When the rating system came in, it was it was a quick, easy, cheap way of being sensational.
To get an R.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but I feel like my entire childhood, I think of like all the movies I went to with my dad in the 70s, you know, you go back and you watch them now and you almost, again, I showed Nancy, my wife, recently High Plains Drifter, and
there's a somewhat misogynistic.
Yeah, I said, you have to understand, but it was an interesting thing. It was like, you have to, you know, there's different kind, this is not Straw Dogs Rape, this is High Plains Drifter, you know, it's.
Yeah, but that was always a little bizarre, even when the picture was new.
But it was still, but that still happens in so many films in that era, where it's just kind of, well, she's enjoying it, or she comes back for more, or she's got it coming, and it's all kind of okay. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And I'm actually amazed that as a culture, you know, men are actually as bad as things are, that somehow we're not as bad as we should be, having grown up on those films, because it's astonishing. Or you look at Once Upon a Time in America, where, you know, like every 20 minutes, they're like, hey, what should we do? Let's go Gang Rape Tuesday. Well,
She
goes, oh, you guys again.
Yeah, it's so true.
It's so bizarre.
Well, that's an Italian movie.
Well, that's Italian, yes. Okay. All right. But we also wanted to talk about, and I think it's interesting to compare them, too, because I feel like there are sort of stylistic similarities. But Anthony Mann was a big influence.
Well, he also started very similarly to her with these with very low budget pictures for RKO and Republic. There are many periods in Anthony Mann.
Sure.
You know, there's this early noir period, and then there's this Western period. And then toward the end of his life, there's the big budget blockbuster period. My least favorite period of his.
Yeah.
And I think that when he was fired off of Spartacus, that was quite a career blow. Even though he did come back and make some big pictures after that, but I mean they were well into shooting when he was fired. And I remember an interview with Peter Ustinov where they said, "So what was it like working with Stanley Kubrick?" And Ustinov said, "I never met Stanley Kubrick because all of his scenes were shot by Anthony Mann."
That's amazing.
You know, and Kubrick was notoriously not very happy on the movie because it wasn't his movie, and you know, it was a big expensive picture for him and all that. And like Douglas had asked him to do it after they had done Paths of Glory. I love the movie, but there shouldn't be really two directors credited on that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't that, which before we get to Anthony Mann, I was surprised to find out that Ilo Pino had actually directed a lot of On Dangerous Ground, which is credited to Nicholas Ray, which she's in, of course. Do you have any idea how that?
No, I don't know the details of that.
Okay.
She also is the only woman who directed two Twilight Zone episodes.
And she did Gunsmoke, and she did...
Oh, she was a regular on Gunsmoke.
Honey West.
So much. Oh, yeah, Honey West. That's right.
But was Man from Miami your favorite Anthony Mann, or is it just sort of the one that came to mind?
You mean the one you were supposed to do for Trailers from Hell about 10 years ago?
I gotta do that. Come on.
I'm still holding the trailer.
Okay, please. I wanna do it.
A lot of you folks have read this story, The Man from Laramie, the Saturday Evening Post. Well, we made a picture about it out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And here are some scenes from The Man from Laramie.
The Man from Laramie. Based on one of the most powerful adventure stories ever to appear in the Saturday Evening Post. Read by millions. Now brought to the screen by the star, James Stewart. The director, Anthony Mann. The producer, William Getz, who gave you the Glenn Miller story, Winchester 73, Bend of the River, and many more.
He was not inclined to speak his mind, the man from Laramie.
You got no cause to shoot me.
Shooting's too good for you.
What did I do to you? Tell me, what did I do? I got a right to know.
Yeah, I guess a man's got a right to know what he's gonna die for.
They're coming for their guns. Kill me and they'll kill you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, the very first, I was telling Joe, the first one of my first movies that I ever saw in the theater was El Cid.
Oh, wow.
So I saw that at the we have a beautiful movie theater, Movie Palace. It's still there. God bless them. And more beautiful now than it was even when I was a child. But a Paramount Movie Palace in my hometown in Ashland, Kentucky. And I saw El Cid there when I was probably about 5, I guess, maybe 6. But, of course, I couldn't understand the subject matter. But what I did was I identified the two women as my mother and her sister. So, to me, the fair-haired woman, I can't remember who played her, that was my aunt. And my mother was Sophia Loren. So that was how I identified with that movie. I was just following those women because those were the two formidable women in my life. So I followed their story. I saw the story through their eyes because I didn't relate to Charlton Heston, obviously, as a 6-year-old girl. But and then later. I think when I was right this summer before I went to UCLA Film School, I saw a bunch of Anthony Mann Westerns. I think I was dating a guy at the time that was like a film nerd or something. And so he taught me a little bit about him and about his movies, about his Westerns. And they were so different to me than Ford's Westerns because Ford's Westerns have this bigger-than-life kind of feel to them. And they're very allegorical and they're very, you know, grand. And Anthony Mann's Westerns are not like that. They're like what it would... Like when you see... I'll just never forget there's like moments in The Man from Laramie, where I still, every time I see it, I feel like I'm on that horse, you know, because I'm just like, and I'm nervous because I can feel the ground underneath. There's just something about it. You're just centered in the space differently, and it's a bit more grounded. I don't know.
Yeah, the characters are a little more human.
Something about it. Yeah, they're more human. The Indians are more textured. They're not kind of, you know, all one painted with sort of one broad stroke. They're kind of, they have more nuance in the they're just, everything's just a little more complicated and a little more shaded, and it's not, the characters are not allegories for anything. They're like, it's like a real guy. Like, I'm just trying to find out how my little brother was killed. He was killed with this rifle. I'm trying to figure out who gave these rifles to the Indians. That's all. Just trying to figure that out. And meanwhile, he meets this lovely woman, played by Kathy O'Donnell, who's just so dear, I think. I don't know what, where she came from or what
she's
happened
such an interesting
to her
presence.
Or what.
Yeah,
she was just in so many wonderful movies. She was in that Nicholas Ray movie, They Live by Night, right? And she's just, I don't know, she's just a plain, sweet girl. And the beauty of it is, he says, well, I've seen pretty, I'll never forget him, so the character says, well, sure, I've seen pretty girls before, but you're kind of beautiful. And that's like, I was like, oh, okay, I'm kind of in love with this movie now. You know, and she has this little tea set she's brought from the West. Now, you could look at the man from the man who shot Liberty Valance, and there's like, you know, things they've brought from the East as well to kind of set up in the West. But somehow it's just a little more personal in the man from Laramie. And there's a whole history with this older couple in the movie too, who had been in love and, you know, had this, you know, have been blown apart, their romance, and we come to find that out. Very interesting older woman. The women characters are fascinating in this movie.
She'd been a silent star.
Yes. I can't remember. Yes, that woman. She's in so many things. Yes, she's fantastic. And so when I went to make Gas Food Lodging, and the original material was set in Chicago. It was a book originally.
Oh, wow.
And it was set in Chicago. And then I totally, like, made it so personal. It was my own. But my producers, they said, yeah, so set it in New Mexico. And I was like, okay. So as I was writing it, I was like, you know, I'm happy that we're setting it in New Mexico, but why are we doing that? And they, one of my producers said, because we want to go there. I was like, oh, okay. I was new. I was like, that's how it works? Okay, good.
There are worse reasons.
I want to go there too. Yeah. So once we were setting it in New Mexico, then I became obsessed with the man from Laramie, because even though it's not set in New Mexico, well, it is set in New Mexico, but he's from Laramie, Wyoming. There is no Laramie, New Mexico, but in my film, in Gas Food Lodging, set in Laramie, New Mexico, because it was an homage to him. I was shooting in his country, and so, you know, that was my Anthony Mann homage. Was
kind of, I mean, James Brolin is such a, you know, I mean, he could have played a sniveling coward, and he still comes across as, you know, the Marlboro Man. So, because he does have some vulnerability and weakness in that film. But I kept thinking, as I was watching it again, I was sort of looking for the connections. I mean, were you thinking at all of kind of?
Well, yeah, a bit with the man from.
Yeah, when you cast him, was he sort of a nod to the Western roots?
Well,
of this
it
thing.
Was great, because at the time, I mean, this would have been the last person you would have thought of at the time to play that part,
yeah.
James Brolin, because, you know, everyone kicked around the same people who had played these kinds of parts to death, you know, as Harry Dean Stanton, of course, and Sam Shepard, and, you know, all of these sorts of guys who were playing stuff like that then. And Larry Estes, who financed the movie through RCA Columbia, was friends with James Brolin. And so my producers were like, now listen, Larry wants you to meet James Brolin. Now you don't have to cast him. But he was, because everyone thought of him as like Marcus Welby or Hotel or, you know, TV guy. And I was like, are you kidding? I love James Brolin. So I was really excited. So there was no hesitation. I was like, oh my God, I love him. I didn't think in terms of TV and movies back then. And of course, we don't have to think about it at all anymore. But then there was a real stigma about TV. So he was excited because he got to do something very different than people would think of him.
Well, I actually remember before I saw the film, finding out he was in it, and there was a moment of just sort of, oh, really? Oh, that seems kind of...
I know.
And then you get in the film,
and he's wonderful. Yeah, he's so great, and he was so, like, heartbroken, and he was broken, too. I mean, very similar kind of thing with Things Behind the Sun, which maybe that's...
A motif.
Characters I like. I like those characters.
Yeah, they're certainly they're more interesting.
Yeah, so he was fantastic. And he also, of course, you know, like a lot of people who had done that much constant work as TV actors would have done back then. It wasn't these little 10 episodes right. a season. It was like, you know, 30 or something crazy. You know, they were working every single day. He knew camera and everything so well. It was like he could just bring those young actors right up. You know, he was just... And this young director. I mean, he was fantastic. And he started out, actually, as a filmmaker. So, but his handsome looks got him in, I think, The Blob or something like that. It got him in an AIP teen horror movie. And so he started acting. But he had... intended to be a film director, so
interesting. I didn't know that.
Did you?
But those two filmmakers is interesting. That you know, I'd never thought of them in conjunction together before. You mentioned that you wanted to talk about them, but then you know, you sort of jump in and going back and looking at some of their films and sort of thematically, as you say, they're both about kind of grounded, realistic, broken characters
that they sort of deal with. Isn't it? Yeah.
But they're also working at the same time. And
in fact, their movies could have been on double bills.
Yeah, some of them could have. I don't even know if there's much to be said. I mean, it's such a ripe subject, and yet it's also so obvious. I mean, there's obvious reasons why Ana Lupino did not have the career Anthony Mann did.
Anthony Mann didn't play any good parts either.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. He had no...
That's right.
He never got to be a leading lady. And who's to say who was more heartbroken about that? But I mean, do you know, was she... You know, I wonder, was she, as a director, was she working as much as she wanted to in between everything else? Do you have any...
Well, she was, you know, when she was doing that TV show I mentioned, I mean, she had already directed a number of movies.
Right.
So then you know, when I was a kid, she did a lot of thriller episodes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh yeah.
And I think she felt that, you know, it was the same time that Joan Crawford and Bette Davis were having to decide whether they were going to have careers as horror movie people, or whether they were going to retire, or whether they're going to start taking smaller parts. But the thing about the horror genre is that it managed to take people, stars, male and female, who had gotten to a certain point where they were no longer headliners, mm-hmm. and make them stars again. Yeah. You know, Vincent Price, Basil Rathbone.
Right. Sure.
I mean, and certainly, you know, Betty and Joan did mm-hmm. got a huge bump out of Baby Jane, and it completely changed the trajectory of their careers. Perhaps not in the way they might have preferred, but the most important thing, that name above the title thing, that continued right until the end for all of these people.
Yeah. And she also, she did direct, I don't know how many films there were. I don't think there were that many films after TV, but she did direct The Trouble with Angels.
That's
which
right.
is just fantastic, you know, with Hayley Mills and Rosalind Russell and then, you know, that there was a sequel to that, not directed by her, Where Angels Go, Trouble Follows. But those two movies set at this convent were really important to me as a kid. Like, I was in the theaters. I think I was 12 when The Trouble with Angels came out, and then I was 13 when Where Angels Go, Trouble Follows. And Those were my jams, man. Those two movies, I was really into them. And they were just these great teen movies, but they also had these really powerful... I mean, all the relationships are females. Mm. It's like, you know, the Stella Stevens and Rosalind Russell, you know, their relationship and the young girls' relationships. And they're really fun movies, too. They really hold up. And Ida really set the bar for the second movie with the first. A lot of people regard the first as the better movie, so...
I need to see. I have a huge Haley Mills gap in my filmic education because at a young age I was told many times I look just like her, which is not something you want to hear when you're a 12-year-old boy. It doesn't make you rush off to see her films. Charles Bronson, I went to see a lot of his movies, but not Haley Mills. Although Pollyanna is one of my favorite movies.
Oh, yeah, me too. It's summer magic for me.
I mean, it's on the subject of Anthony Mann. I don't know, for you or Joe, or am I the only person who likes a Dan Dean aspic?
You may be the only person to sit all the way through it. I mean, that's the movie he didn't finish.
Oh, did he not?
No, he died.
Oh, I did not realize.
He died during the making of that picture.
Well, the film got finished.
And Lawrence Harvey, I believe, finished the movie.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
And that was his last movie.
I kind of weirdly
I find when you get into the Heroes of Telemark period of his career that it's just not as interesting to me because I am so enamored of his earlier work, particularly the black and white stuff
in the West.
I mean, the T-Men and Raw Deal.
Yes,
and yeah. I mean these are and He Walked by Night, which he directed most of, even though he doesn't get the credit for. Yeah. And that's the movie that Jack Webb took Dragnet from. I mean, the whole
and
Richard Basehart is this mad killer, and he's in the sewers.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Crazy.
And it's John Alton. You know, it's great photography, great black and white, and there's a terrific DVD out of it now on Blu-ray.
I saw it on
One of my favorite Anthony Mann movies is a very odd picture set during the French Revolution.
The noir.
It's called The Reign of Terror.
Yes, Reign of Terror. Yes.
Although it flopped under that title, and they reissued it as The Black Book, and that's pretty much the way that you can see it now. But it's a low-budget, incredibly clever use of rear screen projection and parts of sets from other pictures, and it was designed by William Cameron Menzies, who was a great designer. And Richard Basehart plays Robespierre, and the script is very clever and sort of wry. And one of the things that Robespierre runs around saying is, "Don't call me Max." He's very upset when people call him Max, and it's very much of a cartoon. But it's really, 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 really well made, and it's so much fun that whenever I get a chance to turn somebody onto it, I always say, "Well, you got to see The Black Book." I mean, it's so much better than you think it's going to be.
I have a very, very muddy DVD.
Well, there's great DVDs out there now.
Oh, really?
And the TCM version is also a great print. But I hardly recommend it. But also, Raw Deal is a
Amazing.
Yes.
And I think the guy was somewhat underrated.
I feel like he's getting more.
I agree too.
Kind of recognition now. People like him.
That always happens after it's too late.
Well,
yeah, I know, right?
Joe, we appreciate
Where were
you now.
When I was working.
True.
Of course, they didn't have podcasts back then full of people like us.
Guide people to the right movies.
That's right.
That's right.
All of which are now available to see, which is, we were talking.
I know.
You know, you couldn't see Outrage to Save Your Life. It was hardly ever on television. Because, you know, if the theaters shied away from it, you can imagine what Channel 5 thought.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's how I would have seen stuff in like the 70s, the 80s. I would have been watching them late
and then
night
in the mid 80s they decided to stop running movies through the middle of the night. That's where most people found movies was between dusk and dawn.
Well, there are some I feel like Outrage is a movie that never would have since they never say the word, but I mean, I remember Peeping Tom was one that I could never see anywhere. I had to.
Well, that's
well, that was on TV.
But
yeah, that would be on very, very. Oh, that's how I first first saw it would be, you know, when I was like a young mom, you know, I would just watch on my shitty TV.
But the TV version was completely chopped up. And, yeah. And, you know, that ruined his career.
Yeah.
And, it's, and you look at it today, you know, and the movie is really not much more horrific than a Hammer film.
Sure.
But because of the pornography angle, yeah. it just completely killed his career. And he did one more picture, Michael Powell, after that, called The Queen's Guards, which was apparently pretty.
Well, no, there's the Helen Mirren thing.
No, that's before he went to Australia.
Oh, okay.
Because he was packing while they made The Queen's Guards to go to Australia.
God.
Well, I really, really. Have enjoyed this, and
me
Allison,
too.
I want to thank you so much for coming
God,
in.
Thank you so much.
It's been great talking to you about these films and your films.
So good.
And you can hear Allison's thoughts on The Man from Laramie on Trailers from Hell.
Yes, she'll be recording that very
shortly. At some
point
in the near future.
We may lock her in this room until she does.
Only 10 years old. Think of how great this commentary is going to be. She's been sitting on it for 10 years.
I have so much to say.
She's been working on it for 10 years. It's getting it down to 3 minutes is the hard part. By the way, thank you so much
for
coming in.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe, for letting us do this.
Not my house.
Our show is recorded in Hollywood, California, at the crossroads of the world. We are the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is Don Barrett, who also wrote, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.